Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on today's program, North Korea puts rocket into orbit. The Philippines' death toll from the typhoon is expected to rise, and we pay tribute to Indian sitar virtuoso Ravi Shankar. So stay tuned. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. For some time now, many nations around the world have been expecting North Korea to launch another rocket after the unsuccessful one not too long ago, where the international media was invited to DPRK to watch the whole thing. Experts were saying that North Korea was not going to launch another rocket until December 20th. But then, on December 12th, South Korea and Japan started to announce that North Korea had in fact launched the rocket. Not too long later, North Korean television made this announcement.
Kwangmyong-sung 3호 2호기 위성 발사 성공.
2012 is an eventful year to Korea. Another touching news was reported. The second unit of the working satellite Kwangmyong-sung 3 was successfully launched on December 12th. In December, Korea is brimful with joy and excitement, and the whole world is admiring. In the early 20th century, a European writer visiting Korea presented a sculpture of a tearful boy with an A-frame to carry load on his back. It was an epitome of Korea, where only a bellow was heard blowing at the Smith, while others were flying in the sky and generating electricity, a country trampled underfoot as a colony of Japan because of weakened national power. One century later, Korea boasted of itself as a dignified satellite manufacturer and launcher. At present, man-made satellite is the monopoly of a few developed countries, and even though they have their own, some countries should rely on others for its launch. But the DPRK is one of the proud space powers which is developing and launching its satellite entirely with her own technology and strength. Korea already manufactured and successfully launched her first experimental satellite, Kwangmyong-sung 1, in 1998 with her own strength and technology.
North Korean television making the announcement that the launch was successful. Not too long after, of course, news outlets around the world started to report immediately what North Korea had done. Mark Willacy was one of the first to file a report. He's based in Tokyo, and he spoke to ABC television.
Well, what we know, Joe, is that about 8 minutes to 10 local time, North Korea did launch this rocket. It caught everyone by surprise because satellite photographs had suggested yesterday that the rocket was being dismantled off the launch pad because there was a technical problem. It was being taken to some sort of facility nearby where it was going to be fixed. And then all of a sudden we had the Japanese, the South Koreans make an urgent announcement that this rocket had been launched. What we do know then is that the first stage of the rocket, we believed, did splash down in the East China Sea as planned. We are now getting reports that another stage of the rocket has splashed down east of the Philippines, about 300 kilometres east of the Philippines in the Pacific, although there are conflicting reports now that that could have been the entire rocket itself. So we're waiting to hear whether that the rocket has still been flying or whether it is at the bottom of the Pacific.
And there's a chance it could still be in the air if that was only a stage of it, the second stage of it that fell off.
That's right. If it's still flying, it's heading towards the atmosphere, and obviously it will fly over Australia as per dictated by the North Koreans. And if that's the case, this is a major success for them. And I have to say, it has flown a lot further than it did its earlier version in April. It only flew 120 kilometres before it splashed down in the Yellow Sea, and that was an abject failure. But it made it over the Japanese islands of Okinawa. There was no shoot down by the Japanese, which had been threatened if the rocket or part of it threatened Japanese territory. It went over Okinawa, and we understand that either a stage of the rocket or the rocket itself has splashed down in the Philippines. But either way, this rocket's gone a lot further than the one in April.
And just as an indication of just how much concern there is about this in Asia, there's been an immediate reaction from several governments in the region.
That's right, Joe. We've got the South Korean president calling an emergency meeting of his cabinet, his security cabinet as well. The Japanese are also on alert because of this, and there will be a meeting because of that. We understand that the chief cabinet secretary of Japan is holding a press conference as we speak. Obviously, South Korea, Japan and the United States say this is not a rocket launch designed to put a satellite into space, as Pyongyang says. They're saying that this is a disguised ballistic missile test aimed at basically developing a missile capable of hitting America's west coast sometime down the track. So therefore, it is a major threat not only to this region, but to the United States mainland itself. So that's why there is such concern about this rocket launch.
So, Mark, just in relation to those stories from the last couple of days about the expectation that it had been delayed, there was no official word from North Korea at all. This was just speculation based on satellite images.
There was a word from North Korea on the weekend that, yes, it had some problems. Now, that was the word it used, problems. It didn't say anything other than that. A day later, it did say it wanted to extend the launch window from the 22nd of December through to the 29th of December, which seemed to confirm that they were encountering some sort of technical difficulties. And we understood from the satellite photos and the interpretation of those satellite photos from South Korea and also bodies in the United States that this rocket was being dismantled off the launch pad. In fact, one US think tank 10 minutes before this rocket launch had said, look, this won't happen until at least the 22nd of December. So there's some egg on faces here. This is a major failure of satellite imagery and technology and interpretation of that imagery.
And just briefly, Mark, what does this indicate about Kim Jong-un?
Well, it indicates that he's a chip off the old block. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. He's still going to push on with these missile launches, or rocket launches as they call them, because it means that he has a bargaining chip with the West and with his neighbours. And let's expect possibly a nuclear test after this, because that's what's happened the last couple of times that there's been a rocket launch from North Korea.
And that was Mark Willisey reporting from Tokyo. North Korea went ahead with a long-range rocket test in defiance of international warnings. Australia has joined widespread condemnation along with the United States, Japan, South Korea, stating that the action was a clear violation of the UN Security Council ban on ballistic missile tests. The condemnation has been followed by calls for an emergency meeting of the Security Council that was held this week. Tracy Hutchinson speaks next to Professor Andrew O'Neill, a former defense analyst who is now the director of Griffith Asia Institute at the Griffith University in Queensland, Australia. He says the move has major political and security concerns for the region.
Look, I think if anything, North Korea launching missiles, testing nuclear weapons, engaging in destabilizing behavior is probably the one thing that's going to bring South Korea and Japan closer. Both countries are clearly concerned with North Korea's missile and nuclear programs. Both countries have elections coming up. South Korea and Japan both have major parliamentary and presidential elections next week. Mm. So if anything, this is just going to draw these countries closer together. The really interesting player here, I think, is going to be China. China came out and basically said to the North Koreans, don't do this. The North Koreans have done it. So it shows, once again, I think, the limited influence China has in Pyongyang.
Just a little more on that then, Andrew O'Neill, because we know that Kim Jong-un is still a relatively new leader in North Korea. And is this really just an audacious flexing of muscle power by the new North Korean leader and flexing his might on the region?
Yeah, look, I think there is a bit of a look at what I can do. But I think also another contextual factor here is that earlier in the year, I think it was April, when the first attempt to launch a satellite, or satellite slash space launch vehicle slash missile by the new leader, who succeeded his father in December last year, of course, that failed. And it failed in a very public way. The North Korean regime had invited foreign journalists to observe the test. They had opened up the test sites for foreign cameras, and it was a very public humiliation of the new leader. So in a sense, he had a lot to prove. This was risky in one sense, but in another sense, the North Korean regime would have been more able to cover this failure up this time around because it hadn't invited foreign journalists. So ironically, from the regime, regime's perspective, the time it did invite foreign journalists in, it was a dud. The time they didn't, it seems to have been a relative success. So, look, I think a lot of this is also for internal consumption. Clearly, the North Korean economy is in a, you know, a basket case, and launching a missile successfully can, you know, enhance the regime's legitimacy domestically.
You mentioned both Japan and South Korea are gearing up for presidential elections. South Korea, in particular, had said that Pyongyang would need to pay a price if the launch went ahead. How realistic is it, though, that South Korea might respond in a military sense to this?
I think the chances of that happening are about zero because, well, a couple of factors. I mean, I think the issue now is that we know North Korea is a nuclear weapon state. It's tested a nuclear device twice. It now has clearly developed a short and a medium range missile capability, capable of striking targets not just in South Korea but also US bases in Japan, potentially as far afield as Guam. So, you know, it has missile coverage, and we don't know yet whether North Korea has been able to marry any nuclear warheads with any of its missiles. I mean, experts claim they're not yet at that point, but I think we have to be a bit sceptical. I think it's clear that North Korea has made significant inroads in its missile capability. Very few people were willing to predict that this would happen so early in the testing phase. So, look, I think from South Korea's perspective, there would be absolutely nothing to gain from taking what it would see as even a limited surgical strike against North Korea, because the North Koreans themselves would have the opportunity and very much the pretext to strike back against Seoul hard.
You mentioned China's role in this, Andrew O'Neill, and that Beijing had indeed called upon Pyongyang not to proceed with this missile launch. China, too, has a new leader, Xi Jinping. Perhaps is there some element, too, there of those two communist leaders perhaps trying each other out a little bit?
Look, that's possible, but I think, you know, the North Koreans need the Chinese, and frankly, the Chinese need the North Koreans. The last thing China wants is for a renegade regime that is hostile to China's interests on its 1,700-kilometre border with the DPRK. So from China's point of view, it is very important to try and be stern with Pyongyang, but at the same time, not be so stern as to really tempt the North Koreans to call your bluff, because the North Koreans are perfectly aware of how the Chinese need North Korea as well as a buffer state against South Korea in the presence of US forces there. So I think from China's point of view, there is a lot at stake here, but there is also a very strong fraternal link between the two communist parties, and I think we often overlook that in the case of China and North Korea. You know, frankly, I think a lot of people in China see North Korea as an annoying little brother, but at the same time, a lot of other people regard North Korea as being a bit of a useful irritant for the United States to sort of keep the United States, South Korea and Japan a little off balance.
Professor Andrew O'Neill, a former defense analyst who is now the director of the Griffith Asia Institute at Griffith University in Queensland, speaking to Tracy Hutchinson. You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific. The death toll from the typhoon which hit the southern Philippines last week is expected to rise sharply as rescue crews again access remote areas worst hit by the storm. More than 700 people now have been confirmed dead, with over 900 missing, and there are an estimated 100,000 homeless following Typhoon Bopha. Most of the death and destruction hit in the southern island of Mindanao, where heavy rain caused flash floods and major landslides. Mike Wood speaks to Paul D'Orazio, the Philippines Humanitarian Coordinator for Oxfam.
There are like two provinces that were really severely devastated by the typhoon, Compostela Valley Province and Davao Oriental. At the moment, the government is saying that there's already 714 people confirmed dead and 890 more are missing. So we could imagine that in the next few days, the number of deaths could go up to 1,000. These two provinces also has been where there have been many people displaced and left homeless by the typhoon, not to mention that their livelihoods have been severely impacted.
And there's been difficulty accessing some of these worst-hit areas.
A lot of roads and bridges have been destroyed by the typhoon. So, for example, some places that normally could be reached in 1 hour's time, 1 hour time before the typhoon, now it could only be reached in 2 to 3 hours. You would have to find alternative routes to reach this town. So I guess There are even towns that are so isolated up there in the mountains. And in fact, the big concern now is people are not being reached by services. So this issue of accessibility, I guess, has also affected greatly the government's promptness and timeliness in doing its response.
Well, as you just said, much of this problem with access has been caused by flash flooding and landslides. And I believe there's been some finger-pointing among officials over the reason behind that, many people saying it's due to illegal logging in some of these regions.
Yes, that's true. This logging has been in one area in Davao Oriental. The reports I got and the pictures I saw is that in the mud, actually, there were like logs that came with the mud, and that's the one who killed a lot, the people, most number of people. In Compostela Valley, aside from logging, the mining is also being blamed as one of the reason why landslides and the mudslide happened.
Paul, tell us about these areas. What are they like, and who in the main lives there?
These areas are Compostela Valley, actually known for small and large-scale mining operations, and in both provinces, these are where like the big banana plantations can be found. And the Davao Oriental is where large fields of coconuts are situated. So most of the people living in these two provinces, the poorest one, are either small-scale miners or they work in plantations as laborers and farmhands.
Tell me about the scene in these areas, in Compostela Valley and Davao Oriental in Mindanao. Tell me what you see there.
I was only able to go to Compostela Valley, to two towns that were severely hit by the typhoon today. But what I saw today is that people, families, you know, standing by their houses that has been completely destroyed. I saw large, you know, buildings, supposedly large infrastructures like gymnasiums and sports complex, which have been totally wrecked by the typhoon. You know, they're like tin cans now that have been stepped on. I saw children on the streets begging for, you know, any donations or food. Some of them have even placards and signage that says, "We need help and we need food." And I saw vast lands of banana plantations where not a single banana has survived. It's completely flat down.
You mentioned that these are agricultural areas. Farming communities have been the worst hit. I guess it could take many years for these areas to fully recover.
Yes, actually, that's the biggest concern right now. When I spoke to women, for example, that were staying in evacuation centers, they were saying that, yes, they are in dire need right now of food, clean water, shelter repair materials to rebuild their homes. But what's really bothering them right now is what will happen to their livelihood. You know, those bananas would take at least 9 months to, again, bear fruit. The coconut trees that have been fallen would take something like 3 years to again bear fruit. So the women were telling me actually that they're more concerned of their future. What will happen in the next few months, few years? This situation might take 3 years to, or more than 3 years to recover actually.
Paul Del Rosario, finally, what are the most urgent needs in that area right now? And what are the most imminent threats to those who've been displaced by this typhoon?
In the next few days, in the next few weeks, I think what would the bigger problem that they would encounter are people getting sick because of being exposed to the elements. There would be issues around water because at the moment water is being supplied through trucking. There's not enough water sources available around these evacuation centers. Sanitation is also a big concern. In terms of food supplies, at the moment, they were telling me that the local government and some, you know, individuals, some organizations have been coming in and bringing them food supplies. So you know, at least they get something every day, a few kilos of rice and a few tins of sardines. So I think the worry is for how long these food supplies would be available. The local government is concerned about funding that, you know, if it would take a few more months, the funding that the local government have would surely run out.
And we will have more on this story as it develops. You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The music world has lost a leading personality with the death of Indian sitar virtuoso Ravi Shankar. Described as a national treasure by India, he has helped millions of Western classical, jazz, and rock music lovers discover the centuries-old traditions of Indian music. We have this look back at an extremely talented man from Kandahar Sapati.
Ravi Shankar, a sitar player trained in the traditional Indian Carnatic music, will be best known for having bridged the musical gap between the East and the West. Since the 1950s, he had been collaborating with and teaching some of the great Western musicians, including violinist Yehudi Menuhin and jazz saxophonist John Coltrane. But he made it big on the international scene only after hobnobbing with the Beatles and working closely with its lead guitarist George Harrison. Michael Dwyer is the senior music writer for the Fairfax Media in Melbourne.
It's easy to forget, I suppose, that the Beatles were the conduit to worldly experience for our generation. And if that were the case, you'd have to say that Ravi Shankar was almost a spirit guide, because Hindu thought, Eastern mysticism, meditation, seeking the inner light, all these came to many of us for the first time through George Harrison and his first point of contact before LSD and before the Maharishi and all that stuff was the man who he sought out to teach him how to play the sitar, and that was Ravi Shankar.
Although Ravi Shankar became a hippie musical icon of the 1960s and went on from there to work for decades with other traditional musicians, he has always remained true to his traditional Indian classical training, says Dr. Arun Sharma, the chairman of the organization Celebrating India.
He was not directly influenced by that, but his music was influencing them. He went through many years, like 50s, if you look at 50s were different, 60s were different, 70s, the 80s was a hippie time, and then there was a totally different time. And he carried on. His classical music never changed. In fact, he kept reaching more and more people.
Michael Dwyer agrees.
He was quite a purist, and the most recent concerts that he did, I think you'll find that he was still very much upholding a tradition, and he saw himself as a guardian of sorts of that tradition.
Ravi Shankar played the world stage, from Carnegie Hall to Woodstock, and he also gave of himself by pioneering the concept of the rock benefit and organizing the 1971 concert for Bangladesh. But his influence extended beyond just music into the world of films. He wrote film scores for both Indian and English movies, including Gandhi. Sudip Chatterjee, a filmmaker, says Ravi Shankar was the first classical musician to penetrate into the Indian film world and change the formatted nature of film scores.
It was like the director was using other tools like the camera, the lens, the performance. He was also using music to convey not just an emotion but also to build an atmosphere. At that point of time, that was very unusual.
By the 1980s, Ravi Shankar was composing and playing with various international artists, including flautist Jean-Pierre Rampal, composer Philip Glass, and conductors Andre Previn and Zubin Mehta. Dr. Sharma says Ravi Shankar's ability to move easily and comfortably between the Eastern and Western musical worlds made listening to his music magic.
Those joint efforts with different classical players from different parts of the world, they were fantastic. And that took music to a different level, different era.
He has received many accolades. George Harrison has labelled him the godfather of world music. And Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has called him India's national treasure. Dr. Sharma says these are titles well earned.
he was an ambassador to the integration of people through music. Music, he sort of utilized that as a medium to bring the communities together. He was Indian, he was playing Indian music, but he was definitely not entertaining only Indians. He was, through that medium, he was approaching and connecting with wider communities all over the world.
And with that report from Kandahar Sapati, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. You can also listen to this program again, as well as all past editions, by going to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. To end off the program today, we're going to end with a little bit more music from Ravi Shankar. This is from a classic 1966 album that he recorded with violinist Yehudi Menuhin. The album is called East Meets West. So until next time, friends, this is Keith Perron wishing you well, hoping to see you all again in 7 days' time. Bye-bye.